Hey everyone, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. I hope this podcast finds you well and healthy and not too freaked out. I know that with all this virus stuff going around, I certainly have friends in both camps. One camp is, you know, camping out, locked down, plenty of food. And I have other friends that think this is just a bad flu and they're still out there going to restaurants and out and about. I would say that I'm a little bit more on the freaked out side, and certainly for those with compromised immune systems and the elderly, I'm really concerned about how contagious this is, and I worry for those folks. My mom's 80, and she's been on house kind of lockdown because she has some respiratory issues as well, so don't want to get her exposed to any of this stuff. It is certainly for those that aren't concerned. I've had some friends reach out to me that are concerned about the stock market and their 401ks or their savings. And even if you're not freaked out by the virus, it can be a scary time for you on a financial level. So there's all different types of concerns. And, you know, we're not going to debate about which ones are valid or not. I would say that, you know, with all these things, it's the truth is usually in the middle, not at the extremes on both sides. So for me, I'm being extra careful, washing my hands, not trying to expose myself to large crowds or large groups of people, and hoping for the best. I thought this would be a great time, though, to have someone come on the podcast and talk about how to deal with some of this anxiety. And what better person than Sharon Salzberg? Sharon is a dream guest for me. I'm a little bit of a fanboy. I have to say that in terms of the living legends that are out there in the meditation space, you know, there's Jack Kornfield and the Dalai Lama and, you know, Eckhart Tolle and Michael Singer, and up until recently, Ram Dass, who passed away. I would put Sharon on that list of like top five people I would, you know, really want to interview. She's been doing this for a very long time. We get into her history with meditation, what got her involved in meditation. Also talk about how in 1976, she established, together with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield, the Insight Meditation Society, IMS, which now ranks as one of the most prominent and active meditation centers in the Western world. She's also the author of over 10 books, including Loving Kindness, the New York Times bestseller, Real Happiness, and her 2017 work, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection. Like I said, it's a real honor to have her on the show, and I learned a lot. So I hope you enjoy this episode. This is Sharon Salzberg. The first thing I'd love to do is just talk about your background. Like, how did you get started in this journey of meditation?
Well, I went to college in Buffalo, New York, quite some years ago. And when I was a sophomore, almost, I think, by happenstance, I took an Asian philosophy course. There was a philosophy requirement. I had to choose something. I think I looked at the schedule and thought, oh, that fits nicely, you know, into my schedule. Mm-hmm. It's a Tuesday. Let me do that one. And the course just completely changed everything for me. And including that was where I first really heard about these methods called meditation. And the premise was that if you practice these, you could be a lot happier. And I looked around Buffalo. I didn't see anything. This was 1970. And I created an independent study project and asked to be sent to India. And they agreed. I asked to go to India to study meditation. And that's what education kind of looked like then. And off I went.
Wow. So there was not really, I mean, was there any meditation in the West at this point? Must have been pretty spread out.
I mean, there was some, I think, Suzuki Roshi, in terms of Buddhist-oriented meditation,
right.
Suzuki Roshi.
But that was San Francisco. San Francisco, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I met Trungpa Rinpoche. He came to Buffalo maybe 3 or 4 days before I was leaving for India. That was his first visit. You know, so I think it was just beginning to land here.
And then when you were heading off to India, had you sat before? Did you have any sense of, outside of just reading textbooks, did you have any sense of what meditation was all about?
Never. I'd never sat. I had no idea, really. It was just this craving. It's so interesting to look back on it and think, what was that? You know, like, especially because I was 18 years old. I'd never even been to California when I went to India.
Wow.
And I was just so intent on learning the how-to, the real direct instructions, that I just went. And it was so important to me.
If you had to reflect back on that, what do you think that craving, where did that craving come from? Was it something that you felt like was missing in your life, or what drew you into it?
Well, I mean, one of the things that had happened in that Asian philosophy course when they were discussing the Buddha's perspective on life, and they talked about suffering, as he did so often, saying suffering is a part of life. This is natural. This is inevitable. And I, like many people, had had a childhood that was very traumatic and chaotic. And like for many people, my family system was one where you just never talked about that.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to do with all of those feelings inside of me. And here was the Buddha, in effect, saying to me, you're not so weird, you know, like, it's not just you. This is a part of life. And I felt a sense of possibility and belonging that I'd really never felt before. And that combined with the idea that, oh, you can do something about the pain you're in, not the pain of circumstance, but how you hold it, how you relate to it. That's what got me going.
Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty common story. That's certainly my experience as well. I had issues with my father being very verbally abusive, and I just bottled it all up. And, you know, you got to be a strong man and never talk about these things. And yeah, that's what drew me into it as well. So you land in India, and, you know, what's that like? That just must have been insane.
It's crazy. You know, it's totally a madhouse. And I felt at home, I think, from the first moment I was there, and also saw that, you know, nothing in India is hidden. Like, it all happens out on the street, mm-hmm. you know, birth and death. And I had come from this background where so much had been hidden. And it was kind of amazing just that. And it took a while kind of wandering around looking for the very practical, pragmatic situation that I was really yearning for. And started out in Dharamsala because I heard the Dalai Lama lived there. I heard he was a Buddhist. And it was just one of those situations where circumstances just don't work out. Like, I heard there was a very great meditation teacher, and I'm sure he was, a Tibetan Lama. And I'd show up for the class, and they'd say, oh, the Lama had to go to the dentist, who's on the other end of India. You know, like, he'll be back in a couple of weeks. So I'd come back in 2 weeks, and then the translator wasn't there or something, you know, it just wasn't working. And I overheard a conversation at a Tibetan restaurant in Dharamsala saying that there was going to be an international yoga conference, a Hatha yoga conference in New Delhi. And I thought, oh, I'll go there. That's where I'll find a teacher. So I went there, and it was a really dismal experience, the low point of which was these yogis and swamis pushing and shoving against each other to be the first to grab the microphone and speak. And I thought, oh, this is hopeless. But oddly enough, Dan Goleman, who, you know, decades later became well known for writing Emotional Intelligence, at the time was a graduate student at Harvard studying meditation and psychology. For some reason, he was giving a talk at this conference. And at the end of the talk, he mentioned that he was then going to be going to this town called Bodh Gaya, which is the town that's grown up around the descendant of the tree they say the Buddha was sitting under when he became enlightened, and that he was going to be attending this intensive 10-day retreat, like an immersion experience in meditation, without a lot of cultural baggage, without a lot of philosophical exploration. It was really like the straight stuff. This is how you do it. Let me support you and try to answer any questions you have about the doing of it. And I thought, that's it. That's what I'm looking for. And it was what I was looking for.
That's great. And so you went and did your first 10 day. Was it as intense as a lot of these 10 day retreats that, you know, I hear about in terms of, you know, having to sit for X number of hours per day and your back is aching at the end? Uh-huh. Was it one of those?
It was one of those. It was not a completely silent retreat. There were periods of silence and days of silence, but there was sort of a mixture. And we just formed like incredible friendships. And many of us, you know, still many of my closest friends. And it was exciting. It was like this big adventure. Like, I can feel my breath coming in and out or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very difficult because I'd never really looked within, and I was young and very self-judgmental, and I'm somewhat famous. The teacher was S.N. Goenka, and I'm somewhat famous amongst that group of friends for once having marched up to him and saying, I never used to be an angry person before I started meditating, thereby laying blame exactly where I felt it belonged, which was on him. It was clearly his fault.
Yeah.
And of course, I'd been hugely angry and I hadn't seen it. So not only was my back hurting and my knees hurting and so on, but there was all of that was being uncovered.
When was the first time that you felt like a real benefit where you're like, wow, this is something that, you know, it stops to become like something that you're just doing because you're told to do it, but you're actually feeling some type of shift in yourself?
I felt a shift from the first moment I started, in a way. I don't know if it was that exact shift, but I just felt completely confident. There's truth here. There's truth here for me, and this is important. And I've never actually wavered from that.
Hmm.
That was really from the beginning. And there was benefit right along the way, you know. Not the benefit I thought I should have, which was maybe sitting bathed in brilliant white light or something like that, or being right in total bliss. It was nothing like that, but greater ease of heart, more ability to let go, more ability to start over or take an interest in my experience. That was happening pretty quickly.
And how long did you stay in India for?
I ended up staying close to a year and a half, so past my year of independent study. I went back to Buffalo, did what I needed to do to, in effect, get 2 years of independent study credit, went back to India for like another year and a half, so about 3 years altogether.
And what was the transition for you from kind of student to teacher? Was that many years later, or when did you start actually instructing others?
In 1974, I was planning on coming back to the States for what I was absolutely convinced would be a very brief visit back, you know, getting a new visa, all those kinds of things, before I went back to India for the entire rest of my life. And I went to see one of my teachers, who was a woman. She's known as Deepa Ma, or Deepa's mother. It's like a nickname, Deepa Ma. And she lived in Calcutta, and I went to see her just to kind of get her blessing and say goodbye for my very brief trip back to the U.S. And she said to me, when you go back, you'll be teaching. Joseph Goldstein had been one of the friends I'd made in my first meditation retreat, and he'd already come back. He'd been back for about 6 months. And she said, when you go back, you'll be teaching with Joseph. And I said, no, I won't. And she said, yes, you will. And I said, no, I won't. I mean, it's ludicrous. And anyway, I'm coming right back. And she said, yes, you will. And I said, no, I won't. And then she said two things that were pretty incredible. First, she said, you really understand suffering. That's why you should teach. And that was actually a blessing, because I had never really thought about the things I'd gone through as a child, or, you know, as having a kind of benefit in terms of how I might help others.
Mm-hmm.
I also noticed she didn't say like your, you know, scholarship is so impeccable or your realization is so massive or something. She said,
right,
you really understand suffering. That's why you should teach. And then she said, you can do anything you want to do. It's your thinking. You can't do it. That's going to stop you. And I left her room and walked down the 4 flights of stairs to the street. And I just kept thinking, no, I won't. I can't do something like that. I'm not capable of that. And came back to the States, and it was 1974. The Naropa Institute had just opened in Boulder, Colorado. And Joseph was teaching there. He was kind of Ram Dass's TA, teaching the meditation section of his Ram Dass's mega class of like 1,000 people. And some friends and I went to visit Joseph, and he got invited to stay on for the second summer session. And I stayed on with him. And then we got invited to teach a month-long retreat, and we did that. And then sometime later, a 10-day retreat, and we did that. And one day I kind of woke up and I thought, oh, she was right. Look at that.
It must have been a little nerve-wracking to start teaching for the first time. I've One time I was in front of a group of folks and they know that I practice on a regular basis, and they asked if I could lead in meditation, and immediately my heart just starts to just go crazy.
Well, I was petrified. And for one thing, I was petrified of public speaking. And the format of our intensive retreats is that people practice all day and there's teacher contact or there's questions and answers and things like that. But there's only one formal lecture, which is at night. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't bring myself to do it. And Joseph had to give 30 talks because it was a 30-day retreat. People were going up and yelling at him, like, why won't you let her have a voice? Why won't you let her speak? And he would say, I'd be delighted. She just won't do it. And that took a long time, actually, to be able to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Public speaking is definitely a hard hurdle for a lot of people to get over. What are your thoughts on modern day practice? You've obviously been doing this since the 70s, and you've seen so much unfold. You know, when you see different types of meditation apps, and, you know, they seem to be very prescriptive in nature, meaning, like, you know, I have a fear of flying, so there's a meditation pack for that. And, you know, What are your thoughts on the benefits there? Do you feel like there's, you know, people should steer away from those, or is there, have you tried any of them?
Have I tried any of them? I'm on some of them. I don't know if I've ever tried any of them, actually. Come to think of it, I think it's a good thing. It's all a good thing, really, if the person offering the instruction has some understanding. I think it does make a difference, just in the embodied sense of what's transmitted. And I'm not very good at it in a way. I mean, I know what you mean, because people are always asking me, well, couldn't you do a meditation especially for, you know, getting concentrated in the morning? Is one example. And I'd say, well, it's the same one I teach for getting concentrated in the afternoon. It's not like, You know, I don't have like a special package.
Right.
There's fear and there's anxiety and there's accepting joy. And, there, you know, the things we do in just the range of a mindfulness practice ordinarily. And I'm not very good at kind of tailoring it, you know, 1,000 different ways.
Yeah. I'm kind of having a hard time wrapping my head around that, because it seems like the stuff that I see these days, it's like, it's almost a way to say, how can I do this in as quick as amount of time as possible? Mm-hmm. Like, I want to check that box to say I've meditated today.
You
know? Yeah. So it's like, you know, in one sense you're like, well, at least they're doing something, right? But on the other hand, it's like, maybe that is a good gateway into deeper practice.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good gateway, and it's also, you know, not using those things myself, but I do run into people a lot who say, you know, that app really, it gave me an introduction, or that app really helped me, or I've tried for so many years on my own and that app really opened the door for me to have a regular practice. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of great.
That is great. How's your phone been lately in terms of people calling you freaked out about all this virus stuff that's going on?
Nobody has my number.
Okay, so you're fine. Yeah. How about your email address then?
That's a different story. I mean, I think it's totally understandable. And I, you know, I feel anxiety myself. And I came to the recognition that, oh, I'm a senior. I didn't really think of that before. You know, I'm over 60. Look at that. I'm in the target group and I have bronchial conditions. And, you know, this is really amazing. And I think obviously anxiety and panic, and especially panic, you know, is not worth it. It's not onward leading and it's not helpful to anybody. I think it's also, it's an amazing time in that people are being asked to do things that are for the sake of others, often, really. You know, like, not everyone is over 60 or in the target group, and being asked, especially these days, you know, like right now, currently, social distancing, you know, or give up an activity, a very public activity, because you have an elderly relative, or, you know, something like that. I think it's fascinating to think, oh, you know, this is also a time we can come together in a different way and really have a sense of being at one in meeting a challenge.
Yeah, it's well, I was reading some reports of Japan shipping, you know, hundreds of thousands of masks over to China when they were running low, and just like this collaboration between countries. It's a shame that it had to be this that brought us to it, but it's also a beautiful thing to see it unfolding, you know?
Yeah.
One of the things that, you know, I was kind of sitting with these feelings because, you know, I'm in my 40s and I've got a couple of young girls. And I think the biggest thing that I fear is not my own death, but leaving my girls behind without a dad, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that really it comes down to, for so many of my friends, even my serious meditative friends that are a lot more practiced than I am, it seems that we all still fear death.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, when you read the accounts of, you know, some of the great sages, that's something that they were able to get out of and somehow, you know, not have that fear.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we not fear death?
Well, I mean, I come down to thinking it's kind of like animal consciousness, which is the most natural thing. We will fear death, but what do we avoid in life in order to not recognize, oh, that's also true? How much do we seek control? Because that's one of the great kind of myths we're trained to, like if you have control over enough things, you won't die, you know, like you won't have to let go. Or, you know, there's a lot that we can find like beneficial and prosper from in the sense of, you know, fulfillment and fully living, if we actually can bring ourselves to have that reflection. And there may be fear. I think that's inevitable in some ways, but, it's more like the avoidance of it, you know, or being consumed by fear so that we then live in a pretty distorted way. I think that's more of a problem.
Yeah, I feel like we want to control every aspect, you know, and I think that how do you practice releasing control? Like, how can I say, you know, I'm not advocating, like, we all want to do the basics, you know, in terms of washing our hands and being safe and, you know, avoiding certain sick people, but that's a no-brainer. But in terms of just being able to kind of exhale and release a little bit of that anxiety and just say, I'm okay with letting go a little bit. What are some key ways to do that?
Well, I mean, one is what you just said. It's like, remember to breathe, you know?
Yeah.
Like, let's just take a breath. And I think one of the gifts that mindfulness practice has given me is just that kind of acquaintance with my mind, you know, so that when I see myself, I mean, something an example I use a lot in teaching is I talk about sitting and looking at my own fear. And that's sort of one of the aspects of mindfulness. You neither get lost in the story about it or push it away, but you really take an interest in it. Like, what is this? And I realized looking at my own fear that unlike the world's pronouncement, which is also true, that we're afraid of the unknown, I'm actually mostly afraid when I think I do know and it's going to be really bad. And so it's the stories that I tell myself, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, that's going to happen. That's when I really get going. And when I remind myself, I don't know, then there's like space opens up and I think, hey, I don't know. And I can relax.
Wow. That is such an amazing way to put it, because you're right. Like, the fear is not the unknown at all. It's when you think you're going to get it tomorrow and get sick and
that's right.
Somebody has a cough and you're like, oh, now that's going to be on me. And you know, it's, that's crazy. So how do you recommend, you know, I know you have this book, Real Happiness, which I thought was great. And I'm in the middle of it right now. It's a 28-day program that you have for kind of realizing the power of meditation. Where do people begin? Like, let's say someone's listening to this and they're like you were in the 70s, like they have an interest and they have, you know, they're ready to embrace something like this and take on something new. What's a good place to start?
I think it's twofold. One is, what I tried to do in the book or in my teaching is to have some kind of understanding or context, because, for example, we can bring so many of our own habits, especially habits of self-judgment, right into the practice. And so people often will say something like, oh, I tried meditation once, I failed at it.
Right.
And we don't believe you can fail at it because you can't have the wrong experience. But if you ask them, they'll say, well, I failed at it because I couldn't wipe my mind clear of thoughts, or I couldn't have a totally blank mind, or I couldn't have only peaceful thoughts. And we don't believe the purpose of meditation is any of that, that we're working to change our relationship to our thoughts, but not to wipe them out. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it's good to have some understanding. So you can have a better time trying it out, you know, instead of punishing yourself for unrealistic ways, you know, that you're expecting things. So that's part of it. And the other part is just set a structure, you know, make a resolve that's totally reasonable. I'm going to try it for 5 minutes a day for a month or 2 weeks or 10 minutes a day, something like that. Something you can really do, and that's not a lifetime commitment. And then that sets the stage. You know, you can start with something like the feeling of the breath or the many techniques, the many possibilities. You know, you settle on one and give it a try.
Yeah. When you mention punishing yourself for the thoughts, I think that's something that I certainly used to do. And it's a very frustrating thing if you think that you're just supposed to have this blank mind when you begin. One of the ways that I heard put this was that, you know, consider your thoughts like the weights at a gym. Like you kind of need them to transform in a way. And they can be your kind of fuel for your practice. And when I was able to kind of reframe it like that in my head, where I'm like, oh, this is actually a required part of the practice is to have this. That's how I improve. I instantly became more comfortable with them. And then I stopped resisting them. Do you find that's
great. I never heard that before. I like that.
It was an interesting strategy. And it's weird how just like a little shift in your thinking like that can all of a sudden go from this place of anxiety and I'm not doing it right to, oh, okay, well, I'm okay with this then, you know?
That's great.
One of the things that I'll tell you, I don't know how long ago, I guess over a year ago, I was on your website and I downloaded your MP3s and you had a collection that you could download in. And I think that one of the things that a lot of people talk about that you're really well known for is your metta meditation, your loving kindness meditation. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to what is this form of meditation and why you find it beneficial and how one would go about practicing it?
Sure. I mean, when I did my very first meditation retreat with S.N. Goenka in January 1971, India, it was really like a mindfulness retreat. And the very last thing that happened, like for the last half hour or something, was a loving kindness meditation. So that's metta, M-E-T-T-A. And that was when I first heard it. And it really blew my mind. I thought, wow, what is that? And metta means loving kindness or friendship, or I like to use the word connection. And so it's actually a practice that is dedicated to deepening the sense of connection to yourself, to beings you know, friend or neutral person, and ultimately to all of life. And it is its own method as a quality of the heart. It's very tied in with mindfulness, but it is its own distinct methodology. And often it's done, not always, but often it's done with the silent repetition of certain phrases. So that becomes the object of concentration. May I be happy. May you be happy. May I be peaceful. May you be peaceful. Things like that. May all beings be safe, be peaceful. And so we actually rest our attention on the silent repetition of these phrases and see what happens. You know, some people are very squeamish about it. They think it's going to be something phony and you're trying to force yourself to feel something you don't actually feel. And it's not like that at all. I see it as a kind of stretch, you know, it's a way of paying attention differently. It's like, if you think of all those many people we encounter that we don't even really look at, we just kind of look through, we objectify in some way, we discount. And what we're doing is we're stopping and we're shifting. We're saying silently, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, which brings them fully into our consciousness. And so, it's a wonderful practice.
And when you practice that, like let's just say part of the practice is bringing someone to mind that you may have difficult feelings mm-hmm. for. Okay. And let's just say that's someone that, you know, was verbally abusive to you or treated you poorly in some other way. How does one forgive in that moment? And what are you saying those words, even though you may not fully mean them? Where does, and what type of meaning is behind them when you're saying them?
Yeah. I mean, it's a complex issue. Well, first of all, the traditional teachings would say maybe don't start with the most unthinkable person mm-hmm. who has hurt you so badly. You know, start with somebody you feel a little bit of conflict with. And it's really it's like the building blocks of strength training. You know, you don't start with the heaviest weight. You know?
Right.
You're kind of making your way toward there because what we want is an embodied understanding of what it might mean, what it might feel like to have compassion for someone, but also for yourself. Mm-hmm. Or to have compassion for someone and realize I can't fix it. It's not in my hands to control. Or to have compassion for somebody and realize I so fundamentally disagree with you. I'm going to fight. You know, I'm going to fight your agenda. I'm going to fight your actions or whatever. That's not an easy place, but it's a place, you know, of some understanding and love. And so we can grow there. I personally hesitate to use the word forgiveness, although it's a word that everyone asks about it, you know, and mm-hmm. of course I use it, but it's so loaded a term and so many people mean different things by it. Like as my friend, my colleague, Sylvia Boorstein would say, forgiveness does not mean amnesia. Mm-hmm. You know, we think it has to mean like wiping out the record or something and saying what happened didn't matter. Maybe it really did matter and still matters. But there's a certain quality of having lost some of our life energy in the actions of others. As a friend of mine said about somebody he was sort of obsessed about and his bad behavior, he said, I let him live rent-free in my brain for too long. Mm-hmm. It's like we want to recapture that energy and feel whole and, you know, not so beholden to the actions, the unskillful actions of somebody else. And so it's more like in that terrain, you know, of reclaiming that energy and feeling whole.
So it's almost like in a way when you practice with someone that you have maybe a slight disagreement with or mm-hmm. someone that is not, you know, they're not an enemy, but there's someone mm-hmm. that, you know, you're having a slight conflict with, you're giving yourself an opportunity to just soften that a little bit and mm-hmm. develop and release it a little bit. Would you say is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. And there's also kind of understanding, I mean, it depends on the nature of the relationship, you know, and the grievance. But, you know, sometimes there's a kind of understanding that that person is not only that act, or there's a kind of felt sense like, oh, I too act in those ways in some fashion.
Yeah. And then also just not fully understanding the circumstances that brought them to behave like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things that I was able to process pretty effectively with my own father, and he's since mm-hmm. passed, so I can unfortunately no longer have conversations with him. But, you know, just understanding the environment that he grew up in knowing that that anger could stop with me and I could be the one to release it is such a beautiful thing.
it is a beautiful thing.
You know? It's like, that doesn't have to pass on to my girls or anyone else. They could just stop with me. And just like, that is, it just puts a smile on my face. And that never used to be the case, you know?
Yeah, that is a beautiful thing.
So when you're doing these different, they're not really mantras in a way. Cause when I think of mantra meditation, I think of repetition of a saying or a phrase, but kind of not really thinking it through. This is an active thinking process. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of like mantras and kind of not, because mm-hmm. We know what they mean.
Right.
And the meaning is important as well. And in fact, it's kind of a clue when meditators, you know, kind of classically can enter this space of having a lot of tranquility or a lot of concentration, but not a lot of energy or clarity in their minds. And what happens in loving kindness meditation, because those phrases mean something, if you enter that state, is that the phrases get garbled. So I, for example, I heard about this meditation at first in 1971. It was in 1985 that I got to go to Burma and do this intensive 3-month course in loving kindness meditation. And if I entered that zone, you know, I call it the ooze, I would hear myself repeating something like, may you be filled with suffering, may you be filled with suffering. And I'd go, wait a minute, no, it's may you be free of suffering, you know? So it's kind of a good feedback system to us. So the meaning of the words is actually important.
Yeah. In terms of your own personal practice, where has this led you? Like, what transformations have you seen in your own life over the years? And how far do you think one can take meditation?
Well, I'm going to talk about loving kindness in particular. Like they say, the Buddha taught it as a technique to be an antidote to fear. Mm-hmm. And I would say, absolutely, that's been my experience. And it makes sense, right? Because fear energetically has us kind of shrink away and withdraw and kind of implode and be frozen. And loving kindness or love is, you know, connection and openness and so on. So it makes sense. And going back to me being like totally freaked out about giving a public talk, you know, this went on for a very long time and many, many retreats. And my fear was that I'd be talking and then my mind would go totally blank and I'd just be sitting in front of all these people and, you know, saying nothing. And then it occurred to me, this was long before I went to Burma, I thought, you know, there is that one practice, loving kindness. And if I was talking about that and my mind went blank, I could just launch into the guided meditation and nobody would know. So for a long, long time, I could only give one talk, which was on loving kindness. And then one day it struck me, you know what? Every talk is about connection. It's about love or loving kindness. Nobody's sitting here waiting for me to impart my incredible expertise. You know, we're just here together and we're going to connect. And that's when I could talk about anything. You know, so it's something about that energy that is very liberating, and I felt it over and over again in my life.
Yeah. Were you, having kind of grown up during this time, were you friends with Ram Dass?
Ram Dass was one of the people I met at my first retreat in January of 1971, and we were friends from then on.
I was really sorry to hear about his passing.
Yeah.
You know, I was listening to one of his audiobooks recently, and it was, he was such a great speaker. I mean, just
amazing.
Was it amazing? Amazing. What would you say that you learned from Ram Dass?
Well, I mean, when you listen to Ram Dass pre-stroke, it was like, that was his superpower, his voice, his articulation, mm-hmm. his brilliance as a speaker. And it was so kind of stunning and shocking.
Yeah.
Post-stroke, you know, when he, there would be those long pauses and as he searched for a word. And there were so many times I'd be sitting on a stage with him presenting, co-presenting. And you could just see him struggle for the word. And it was so clear what he was trying to say. And so tempting to just fill in the word. And I knew that was the wrong thing to do. I just had to sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait with everybody else. And the fact that he got out there and he did that, he didn't hide. He wasn't humiliated by it. He didn't even experience it as a loss. He just thought, okay, this is how it is now. And the silences are also a teaching. Somebody asked him pretty close to his death if he felt old. And what he said was he really only felt old when people provided the word that he was searching for. That's when he felt really old. And watching him, I would say like before the stroke, he was brilliant. He was amazing. And it was real. You know, he was not hypocritical and his struggles were real and quite out there. Mm-hmm. as a human being. And some of that struggle was kind of a self-hatred, or which manifested as not being able to accept very easily. He was a giver. He was a helper. And I mean, you couldn't even really give him a birthday present without him complaining. You know, he was like difficult. And after his stroke, we were teaching together in Hawaii, and he was giving a talk, and he said the hardest thing of all, more than the pain, more than the disability, more than living in a wheelchair, more than the speech, the aphasia, was having to accept help. And he said it was the hardest thing and the most liberating thing. And he went on to say that one of his famous books was called How Can I Help? And he said, now I feel like writing a book called How Can You Help Me? And that transition, or that transformation, it was like he just became transparent. The love came in, the love came out, and it was all love. I didn't go to his last retreat on Maui, but I watched some of it on the live stream, and he could hardly speak at that point. He was mostly sitting up on the stage and waving at people, or following along with the chanting or something, but he was beaming and so radiant. And it was really like an amazing teaching.
What a crazy transformation to have occur.
Yeah.
And watch. Wow. Yeah, that's I didn't get a chance to meet him, but I'm certainly a fan of his his teachings. Like just watching him in his prime was unbelievable.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on, I know Ram Dass was a proponent of this back when he was younger, but it seems to be there's like a resurgence in kind of recent days in terms of people embracing psychedelics as part of spiritual transformation. You know, obviously there's a lot of great work being done on the PTSD front and really helping people with serious issues. Where do you think this is going, and what's your take on that?
Well, I also appreciate the research and hope that it can continue. You know, people are often suffering mightily in all kinds of different ways, and it seems to be a pretty effective tool. Fear of death, PTSD, all kinds of things. You know, I don't myself take psychedelics. That was a long time ago. People ask, like, did you ever? And I say, I'm a child of the 60s, you know. It's like, but, you know, Ram Dass's own guru named Kirali Baba was kind of famous for saying things like, the yogis have always known about this kind of sacred medicine, and it can get you in the door, but you can't live there. You know, for many people, getting in the door is phenomenal and revolutionary, and I think that's great. It's also interesting, you know, to see how carefully the research is being conducted and the clinical settings. You know, it's pretty great.
Yeah, I love everything that's being done on that side. My only personal concern is that people will use it as a substitute for the hard work. You know, it's like they no longer have to hike up the mountain. They're just taking it immediately to the top. It's interesting to figure out, you know, how as a society, how we'll figure out how to balance all of that, you know?
Yeah.
But I do absolutely. I mean, when it's being used in such compassionate scenarios as end of life and PTSD and severe trauma, like it is a no-brainer. That's such a helpful thing for people. I do want to mention your book, Real Happiness. I think it's a phenomenal guide for people to get started in a great 28-day program. What are some other things that, where can people find you online? And are there other resources that you would point them to?
Well, my website is SharonSalzberg.com, and so there's a bunch of stuff on there. I am on some apps, you know. In fact, most particularly 10% Happier.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
And Insight Timer, increasingly, and some others. Every February, we run a 28-day challenge on my website in harmony with this book, Real Happiness. And, you know, just ended. And I asked somebody who like organizes it for me technically. I said, do you think we should just like run it again now? Because it's a time of so much anxiety. I'm also on Happify.com, which is a site that has, all kinds of different things, you know, courses and games, and they provide the meditations for that challenge, which is why I just thought of them. And they also have, they have two animations of me that they've produced, which I think are just the cutest thing. Like I went into a store, into a studio, and told a couple of stories, and they had them made into animation. So there's one, for example, where every character is a dog. So you see this dog's mouth move and my voice is coming out of it. It's really very cute.
That's amazing. That's on Happify?
That's on Happify.
That's great. Before I let you go, and I definitely encourage people to all to go check those out and definitely pick up the book, can you point me to a few other resources or maybe books that have personally changed your life? Like, are there things that you say, well, these were really instrumental in informing my thinking?
Well, one book that I always talk about is Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki Roshi.
Wonderful book.
Which is so simple, and that's what is so difficult about it, and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And even just the very concept was kind of beyond me. It came out on that trip back I took to the States to finish college and then went back to India. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, I know what that's about. It's about, like, you start with this beginner's mind and it's kind of awkward and clumsy, and you work and you work and you work and you transcend, and then you get a Zen mind. And I didn't buy the book. And then I went back to India and somebody sent it to me and I read it and I thought, whoops, you know, got that totally wrong. It's the opposite. You know, the beginner's mind is actually the goal, and it's a beautiful book.
You know, the crazy thing about that book is I feel like I can pick it up every few years and read through it again. And then you're like, oh my God, I learned something totally new. You know, like there's always something new and a new takeaway that you can discover in there. There's like these little hidden nuggets of knowledge that I feel like you just need time to sit with. And then all of a sudden you start to realize and unpack a little bit more every time you read it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. And I'd say in current time, sometimes I look at my colleague Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, which is size-wise, it's the opposite. It's like a brick. Mm-hmm. But you can get it on Kindle because I think it's fascinating to look more deeply into a word like mindfulness, which is used so casually and can mean so many very different things. And I appreciate the scholarship of it.
That's great. So I haven't read that. So Joseph Goldstein, Mindfulness.
Yeah.
Any other courses or any other teachers that you really like?
Oh, I also have courses.
I would love to hear about your courses as well.
Yeah, I have often through Tricycle Magazine, I do different courses. Some are up, kind of evergreen offerings. One is starting, I think, March 23rd. Some are about loving kindness or love. This next one is about basically the Eightfold Path, about morality or ethics, and then concentration, and then wisdom.
And where do I find those? Where can I access if I want to sign up?
You can access that either through my website or Tricycle Magazine's website. Okay. I often go to something like Tricycle Magazine to see their online offerings and to participate. And also Sounds True.
Yeah, Sounds True is a fantastic resource.
Yeah.
I just took Michael Singer's course there, which I thought was absolutely wonderful.
That's great.
I'm sure you've met him before or know him well.
I don't know if I've met him.
You haven't.
Best title of a book ever, you know?
His
Untethered Soul.
Yeah, and his course on surrender there is it's just so good.
Yeah.
Well, Sharon, thank you so much for your time. I know how valuable it is, and so I appreciate you spending it with me for this interview.
Oh, well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
All right, that is it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun to sit down with Sharon and have this conversation. What a fantastic human being. If you enjoyed this episode, please head on over to podcast.kevinrose.com. I've got a really easy way for you to review the show now without having to hunt around. Just head there, podcast.kevinrose.com, and at the very top navigation, you'll see a button there that says Rate Show. Tap that, and it'll take you directly to giving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate it. That'll get us recommended to more people and, in turn, get us better guests for the show. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all stay well.